An unsolved murder comes to light after almost 70 years. In 1999, art dealer Alex Clayton stumbles across a lost portrait of Molly Dean, an artist's muse, brutally slain in Melbourne in 1930. Alex buys the painting and sets out to uncover more details, but finds there are strange inconsistencies. Molly's mother seemed unconcerned by her daughter's violent death. The main suspect was never brought to trial despite compelling evidence, and vital records are missing. Listen to Catherine Kovacsik chat about her incredible novel, The Portrait of Molly Dean, a story about the unsolved murder of a young woman in the 1930s. I'm your host, Danny V. If you enjoy this episode, check out our back catalogue, where we speak to Craig Johnson, who wrote the Longmire series, Tim Harris, Kate Forsyth, Tristan Banks, Bridie Jabour, and many more.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Much for joining us today, Catherine. I'm very excited to talk to you about your book, The Portrait of Molly Dean. I found it such an intriguing read, so welcome.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
I really did, and what I found so interesting was the coming together of fact and fiction. And in your author's notes at the back of the book, you go into detail about Molly Dean, her lover Colin Colohan, and the fictitious elements of the novel. How did you go about deciding what you keep and what you create?
It was really hard. It was a bit of a juggling act. At times, you know, I felt I'd really like the story to go in a certain direction, but I had the facts in front of me as much as they're known, so they sort of really dictated what I did with the story. But I was also very conscious that I didn't want to start with a story where girl dies, someone investigates. I really wanted this to be about Molly, for her to be really the subject of it rather than just an object, and for her to have a bit of a voice.
And how did you first come about this story? Because after I read it, I was researching the real Molly and the real Colin, and it's such an intriguing story with, you know, all these mysteries surrounding it. And so how did you first come about the story?
I first came across Molly probably about 15 or 20 years ago, and I was researching Colin Colohan and the artists in that Meldrum circle. And she was very much a footnote to their entire story, Colin certainly, but really the whole group. And you'll find references in terms of, you know, Colin's timeline of his work. You know, 1930, Colohan's lover murdered, career briefly stalled. Exactly that.
And wow.
And there was really nothing much about her. You know, there was something else where one of the other artists was annoyed because they had a group exhibition planned and her death happened just before that, and it really, you know, it put the brakes on the whole exhibition. So it was really quite distressing to find this young woman who'd been brutally murdered, and her entire life was reduced to this sort of inconvenience for other people and really a footnote to their story. So she kind of stuck with me for all those years, kept cropping up in other bits and pieces of research that I did. And then I was looking at Colin again and I came across an exhibition catalogue of his, and in it was listed, you know, about number 9 or something, Portrait Molly Dean. And I thought, oh, and I spoke to some of the Colohan experts and none of them knew where this portrait was. And that sort of gave me the little hook for the story. But also I thought the way he'd written her name, Molly with a Y, I think in all the newspaper reportage, it was with a Y, with an IE. And so she was this very enigmatic person. No one even knew how to spell her name properly. And suddenly he was the man that she was in love with, who was in love with her at the time. And that was how he'd written her name. And so there were all these little bits that seemed to come together and flesh out that story, the missing portrait, the way her name was spelt. Just those little bits that suddenly sort of really brought her to life for me and gave me an idea about how I could move into her story.
I find it so intriguing that there are so many of these forgotten women of history. I've spoken to Kate Forsyth and Jackie French, who often have these female protagonists who are forgotten women of history, and I found it so refreshing and so empowering, I guess, that you were able to give this woman a voice. How did it feel for you to be able to give this woman, who, just like you said, was a footnote, this incredible voice in this story?
It was great. I was very conscious that, you know, I didn't want to do anything to offend her in a way, you know, so I wanted to give her a life and a powerful voice, but I also really wanted to stay true to what I could intuit and what I could read of her character in the various, you know, newspaper articles and details that were known of her life. And there's not much, but, you know, there are just glimpses that really give you, or for me anyway, an insight into her character. So I really wanted to be respectful to who she was as a person, but I did really want to bring her whole story out too.
And her murder was never solved in real life, was it?
No, it wasn't.
And isn't that incredible? And so how did you then decide to shape your story, without giving away spoilers for those who haven't read it, how did you then decide to go, okay, well, here's, you know, the fact part of it, but I'm going to add my own element to it while still keeping the truth?
Well, I think for me, having that unsolved element, that, you know, originally the obvious thing would be, oh, do a true crime book. Mm-hmm. But there really isn't much available in terms of the detail of the crime because it was never solved. And to me, that I'm one of those people that, you know, if you get to the end of a book and there's one of those really annoying endings and you just want to throw the book at the wall, I really hate that. So I was also conscious that I wanted the reader to have some sort of resolution, but I wanted a resolution for her as well, mm-hmm. even if it is a fictitious one.
And it is a possibility. I mean, I read through, like I said, the author's notes, and it showed there were some characters in her lives that could have influenced her murder or been responsible for her murder. So it was interesting that it was kind of a possibility.
Absolutely. And certainly there were a couple of people in my research, you know, there was a couple of people looking at her murder in sort of the late 70s, early 80s. And one of them was very, very convinced that there was a huge conspiracy theory that went all the way up to, you know, Spring Street and the halls of government and the top levels of police, that everyone was somehow conspiring to cover up the truth about Molly Dean's murder. So there's all sorts of theories and thoughts swirling around.
That's incredible. Was there something that really stood out or really surprised you about the research you undertook?
For me, I think it was her mother, who I think really you could almost classify as a sociopath as far as Molly was concerned. And just the strangeness of her behaviour and her responses, you know, things like telling the police, oh, don't bother investigating, I wish you'd leave it alone, you'll never get the man who did it. And when they first arrived on her doorstep at 2 a.m. in the morning, her response was, whatever she's done, she's brought it on herself. It's just such strange reactions for a mother, and really right through interviews with police and into court, it was just bizarre.
Yeah, and that character, she was a very disturbing and you know, prominent character in the novel, because it was just such unusual responses to having, you know, your daughter murdered and those responses she was giving. So, yeah, I totally agree. That surprised me as well. It's amazing that it's actually the true part of the story, isn't it?
I was left with the feeling that certainly that her mother knew more perhaps than she'd revealed. There was strange behaviour, but it's really hard to explain, but there were sort of bits that I even felt I had to leave out because you thought, oh, I can't put that in because it's too odd. For example, at one point when she had the police in for a subsequent interview, she brought them into her bedroom so that they could talk about things there. And I just thought, wow, this is 1930s, you know. A middle-aged woman doesn't really do that.
And the relationship, the strange relationship she had with that man as well.
Absolutely, yes, Adam Graham.
Yeah, very strange. Look, I love stories from the past, and this novel set in 1930s Melbourne, I love an insight into that kind of era. What did you, or how did you go about researching this particular context beside the research of Molly Dean?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly a lot of Elwood is still very much the same, so just walking around those streets where Molly walked was quite interesting. Old magazines, the Home magazine is quite lovely, and catalogues like the Foy and Gibson's, you know, mail order catalogues for clothing and things, and historical photo archives. I think for me it's almost a visual thing, just being able to see buildings and streets and people too, the way people dress and the way people carry themselves, I think is really important.
And setting is one thing, I guess, because you can look at all those catalogues and get that kind of feeling of the setting. But how do you create an authentic 1930s character voice?
For me, because I have the other protagonist, Alex Clayton, who is in a more contemporary setting, I found I really had to separate the writing of the two characters because they do have very different voices. So I think it was certainly some of the reading. I mean, even just reading the like the Home magazine, the style of writing in that is quite different too. So that sort of that gets you into a little bit more of the behavioural space, I suppose, and the way people carry themselves, the way they would converse, and the formality, I think, too, of stranger meeting stranger, or just a more general conversation. You know, there were sort of things you didn't do. And that was also interesting considering the art community, because they were a more bohemian set. They did have a slightly different approach to life. And they did tend to sort of set Melbourne on its ear a little bit when they went out and about. So that was really interesting too.
I really loved the parallel narratives between Molly Dean and Alex Clayton, because I think they were both strong female voices, but they gave a nice structure to the novel and conveyed not only the past, but how the present is impacted by the past. Was Alex always going to be part of the novel as you were researching Molly Dean, or when did she emerge?
Alex really emerged when I found that catalogue of Collins and found the painting, and found that the painting was not known about amongst the Colahan experts. So that was when I sort of thought, aha, if I have someone now who can be looking for that painting. And she was definitely always going to be a woman, because I really had that feeling of having the two women trying to make their own career paths and sort of contrasting the time periods and what they could and couldn't achieve in those times.
And there were similarities between Molly Dean and Alex too, because they were both quite modern women of their time, failing to fit into current societal expectations and what it meant to be a woman in the 1930s, and even Alex goes against the grain of what her mother expects that her job might be. So I found that was interesting as well. And Molly Dean, I love that in the 1930s, how she says being a wife was not part of Molly Dean's plan. I mean, in the 1930s, that was a big deal.
I think that was a huge deal. And the fact that she had such aspirations, that she had a good job, but she wanted more. She wanted so much more. And she was prepared to put everything on the line to go for it.
And there's quite a lot of knowledge of art in the novel too. Is this something you had to research, or was this is this a passion of yours?
I certainly did a bit of research, but I do have a background in art history, and Australian art is my particular interest and focus. So a lot of it was there, but fleshing out some of the details certainly needed a bit more research.
What surprised you about some of the art world or the bohemian lifestyle that you researched?
I think the interesting thing was, well, certainly for Molly, the bohemian world was the safe world. She was still an outsider there, and that was interesting too, because for all their liberal ideas, she was still a middle-class girl, and a lot of them came from, you know, slightly more privileged backgrounds. So she was still a bit of an outsider because of that, despite the fact that they professed to be, you know, all-encompassing and, you know, come one, come all, so long as you can paint, write, or speak, you know, very eloquently. And she could. She could certainly speak eloquently. But I think certainly for the women, there was still this thing that she was not quite one of us. So I think that was really interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too, because you're saying these bohemian groups had this, you know, their liberal ideas and they were ahead of their time, but they still, even in that circle, had these expectations of women. And when Molly says, you know, oh, I don't cook or I don't prepare food, they kind of looked at her like, who are you? And yet they were trying to be ahead of their time. I found that really interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think also, you know, there was a little bit of a thing, you know, that Molly was perhaps, you know, using some of the group to get where she wanted to be. But they all seemed, you know, they bounced off each other, and if one was having an exhibition, you know, they'd try and, you know, piggyback on that. So it was very much the done thing. But yes, there was still a perception that she wasn't quite one of them.
So she was ahead of her time even amongst these bohemian people, which I found really interesting and impressive. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
What I found shocking about reading a book of a woman's murder is, in light of current events, as I'm sure you've seen on social media and the news, that it feels like not much has changed since 1930 when it comes to the safety of women in our society. What stood out for you in terms of the parallels between the 1930s and today?
I think that's really true, and we seem to often look at the past with rose-coloured glasses and think, oh, people left their doors unlocked and, you know, you could do this and you could do that, and certainly they did. But there were a lot of crimes against women at that time. You know, when I was looking around the time of Molly's murder, and if you read the book, those other crimes that were occurring were legitimate crimes at the time. And I think it's tragic that it's still the same. Nothing has changed, that a woman walking home at night is still not safe. And Molly was 2 minutes from home, as you said, just like recent events. She was very close to home in a place she knew well on a weekday night. There's, you know, she should have been safe.
And it's disturbing that this many years later we're still in a very similar spot, aren't we?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And also what I found really difficult to sort of digest was the fact that it remained in real life unsolved. And it didn't seem like many
people were putting that much effort to get it solved besides the one detective who was quite passionate about it, but the mother, and then it just kind of disappeared. Like, isn't that strange?
I thought that was quite staggering that, yes, as I said, that her mother wasn't interested in them following up.
Yeah.
The police were quite dogged, and they seemed to have sort of certain leads and be going in a particular direction, but perhaps it was that they focused too much energy in the one direction, because when that all fell apart, it did. It just disappeared from the media, and that was the last that was heard of it. It just seemed that they had nowhere else to go. But there were also, you know, odd things like not wanting to look for the murder weapon too hard and not wanting to put up a reward. It was odd. It was very odd. But, yes, the fact that it just stopped when that main suspect was out of the picture was quite surprising.
Yeah, it's very strange. And unfortunately, they didn't have the technology that we do today, DNA, et cetera. So
fingerprinting was in its infancy, yeah. But, you know, without any prints to compare anything to,
yeah.
What could they do?
That's right. And I've spoken to many authors who are teachers and actors and journalists, but I've not spoken to a writer who teaches dogs to ride skateboards or who is a vet. I really loved the Catherine Kovacsik was a veterinarian, but preferred training dogs to taking their temperatures. And then it says that in your spare time, you teach other people's dogs to ride a skateboard. Please tell me all about this.
Well, I do teach some dog classes every now and then these days. My time is not quite as free as it was. But we like to have fun classes, and I really like teaching the fun classes most of all, because people often get hung up on the dog must sit, heel, walk this way, and we teach all that sort of thing too. But it's lovely to have a class where you teach dogs to do fun things, and you watch the owners laugh with their dogs. And dogs are like people. They have things that they're good at and they have things that they're not so good at. So if you can't ride a skateboard, maybe you can play quoits, or maybe you can curl up inside a tyre or a suitcase. So it's lovely finding what dogs like to do and watching owners relax and just have fun with their dogs.
And I like how Alex had quite a loving relationship with her dog as well. So I'm sure that came somewhere from your life.
Absolutely. It was actually quite interesting because I had several people there are a couple of dog park scenes in the book, as you know, and I've had several people say to me, oh, that border collie in the park, that was my dog, wasn't it?
And what's the hardest dog to train? Are there particularly naughty dogs that won't do anything?
Oh, no, look, I think it's just a matter of finding out what dogs are like people. You have to find out what they're excited about doing. So some dogs, you know, don't like to retrieve, but they like to do other things. And they have different interests and they have different things that motivate them. So it's the people that are harder to train, really, because they have expectations that their dog will be. It's like the perfect child, you know.
Maybe similar to your dog training classes, you can have the owner's training classes as well.
I think so.
Now, I speak to a lot of writers about writing process. Some people let their characters drive the story and are quite surprised. I mean, I know this was quite research-based, but What is your writing process and what was your writing process for this particular novel?
I found certainly with the historic side, I'm very detail-minded, so I had to get my details straight to write sections. If I didn't know what the telephone was going to be like or something like that, I couldn't proceed because it bothers me too much. But I found certainly for Alex's plotline, I knew where she was going and how that was kind of going to unfold for her. So she did drive it to a certain extent. There are a couple of things that surprised me. That I hadn't expected were going to happen, and they did. But by and large, I sort of had a reasonable idea of where things were going, but I'm not a real plotter. I'm not a sort of a scene-by-scene, this happens, then this happens. I just kind of have a general, you know, a nice meandering A to perhaps G to then M kind of pathway, and the in-between bits sort of come as they do.
And what were the surprises? I love it when authors surprise themselves.
I think there's Alex and John are sort of developing a little bit in their relationship in subsequent books.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of a bit unexpected because they've been mates for a long time. So that sort of came out just the tiniest bit in that book, but there is a subsequent book that will be coming out in which things change a little bit. So that was a bit unusual. And I think just Alex's strength of character, I think She surprised me a little bit in the way she responded to certain things. And just sort of how gutsy and determined she was. I hadn't quite anticipated that when I first met her in my head.
I did feel the Alex and John vibe, I've got to say. I did feel that throughout the novel. And it must have been nice too, because I guess you were limited in some ways with the character of Molly because she was a real person. But with Alex, I guess you had that freedom. So you had that juxtaposition of a bit limited, but the character of Alex, you could kind of take her wherever you wanted.
Absolutely, yeah. And it was really quite evident to me in the writing process that I'd had that freedom with her. So it was great.
And your publishing process, again, I speak to a lot of people and I just love people's publishing stories because I know there's so much hard work, so much talent, also a bit of luck involved sometimes. What was your publishing process?
Well, I actually went to a speed pitching session and I think there was five publishers there and everyone was interested except for the last publisher. And we ended up having a conversation about dogs because she'd just adopted a dog and she was in trouble with her dog. So we were talking about things she could do with her dog, and I ended up giving her my card because she said, oh, yes, lovely, your manuscript sounds really interesting. I can get you details from the organisers if I'm interested. And I thought, okay, that's that then. But I ended up giving her my card because we were talking about her dog. And she emailed me the following week and said, I just wanted to ask you a few more questions about my dog. Went through the email, and at the end it said, oh, and perhaps you could send through a couple of chapters as well. And I thought, okay, that's very polite of her. She's really just wanting to pick my brains about her dog. But as it happened, that was the publisher that I went with from all the interest at the speed pitch. And I picked up an agent in the interim, so that was really good to have an agent on board when we got down to the contractual side of things. But, yeah, so it was the publisher that I thought had absolutely no interest in me at all, who was just a stealth publisher. And was coming at me another way. So that was quite lovely. And so that was Angela Meyer at Echo, and they've just been magical to deal with.
Yeah, that's so funny that dogs, again, have become such a huge part of even your publishing process.
You know, I spoke to every publisher at that speed pitch session about their dogs, which was kind of weird, but yeah.
Take us through the speed pitch. What's that like?
Well, it's very nerve-wracking. It's like speed dating. You have a lot of aspiring authors and four or five or however many publishers in a room with tables, and you have about 3 minutes to make your pitch, give them the synopsis of your book, tell them how great it is, then someone rings a bell and you just move on to the next publisher.
Three minutes? How do you do that in 3 minutes?
That's right, yeah.
Wow. So what was your pitch for this book? Can you remember?
It was a lightning synopsis, about a 300-word synopsis, and a bit of a comparison of, you know, where it would sit on a bookshelf, so what titles were sort of similar to give them an idea of where I saw it fitting into the whole thing. And obviously the fact that it was based on a true unsolved crime.
Do you read a lot of historical fiction as well, or was this just a particular story that stood out for you that you needed to write?
I read all sorts of things, so historical fiction, modern. I actually like dipping back into writers from that period and from, you know, sort of the 50s, and particularly, you know, crime writers like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. Charlotte Tay is another one that I've been – Charlotte J, rather, is another one that I've been reading lately, who is an Adelaide woman who wrote crime in the 1950s, and she writes very very powerful psychological thrillers. So she actually won the first Edgar Award, which is quite impressive, I think. A woman from Adelaide winning the Premier Crime Writers Award when it first happened.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty fantastic. Yeah.
I love to hear what authors are reading. I find it really interesting to see what their influences have been, or even not influences, just what you enjoy. Do you often pick up, you know, writing style or processes from other writers?
I think you can't help but pick up bits and pieces, and I think there's always books, you know, when you're reading and you're very conscious of just how lovely the prose is, or even if it's just kind of not all fantastic, but suddenly there'll just be a sentence or an image that you stop reading and just think, wow, that was just really nice, and you reread the sentence because it was such a nice sentence. So I think there's always little bits and pieces, and it's also nice to see how writers, you know, tackle plot lines and overcome things to get to where they ultimately want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you say there's another book in the pipeline. What can you tell us about this?
Well, it's Alex and John again, about the same period, so just early 2000s, and Melbourne art. Not so much history this time, so just one storyline. to keep you entertained, hopefully. And a lot more art, a lot more contemporary art, and a lot more Alex and John and Hogarth, the dog.
I liked the dog. So is this completely fiction? It doesn't have any of those factual elements?
No, completely fiction this time, except obviously for the art. And this,
Yeah, no, it's something you need something to do with that research. All that research you did, you need to use it.
Oh, there's plenty more. And we're talking about forgotten women earlier, and gosh, forgotten women artists of Australia in the late 19th and early 20th century. There's a lot of them we need to talk about at some point, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, like I was saying about Kate Forsyth's book, Beauty and Thorns. I mean, all those women, they were models, but they were also artists, and they're just gone. And all you see are the male artists that are left. So I think that's really important. Absolutely. I think they're really important stories to tell. So I look forward to it. What stages is this book in?
This one it's coming up to the editing stage now, actually. So nicely advanced.
Wonderful. So it's written. And so are you having a rest, or is there some other idea that's formulating in your head?
I thought I was having a rest, and actually I thought I was going to write something completely different, because I had this other protagonist he's basically been sitting in his car in my head, revving his engine very quietly.
I love that.
But I was about to start writing him, and then I had this other character pop into my head, and he was standing there rocking backwards and forwards on the balls of his seat with his hands in his pockets, and he just had his story just there to tell. So that's the direction I'm heading in at the moment.
Wow. And so the man in the car just has to keep waiting.
I know. I'm sorry. This is making me sound quite deranged. I realise that.
No. I hear this all the time. I hear this all the time from writers about these characters that, you know, are forcing them to write about them. And I love that kind of visual imagery of that man in the car just patiently revving, and then he nearly got his story and then he missed out again.
Yeah. You just have to wait, I'm afraid.
Well, maybe his story just needs more time to develop in your brain and it will become something wonderful.
That's what we'll say. We'll call it that.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. I love historical fiction, and I love going back into time. And I actually find historical fiction, I know this might be really bad, but so much more richer for me than just researching. So I love that you've been able to research for me, and I've been able to enjoy this book and learn about art and history and the 1930s. It was such a great read. I really enjoyed it. And it just added so much more, knowing that this woman was real. And finally, even though in real life she hasn't had her murder resolved, finally she has had a voice and a purpose and becomes more than a footnote. So I think that's really special.
Thank you, Danny. That's what I wanted to achieve, so it's just lovely to hear you say that.
Well, thank you, and maybe we can speak again and talk about John and Alex in another year or so.
It'll be fantastic. I'll look forward to it.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Danny.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.